This is Audible.
A New World Awakening. Written by John O'Brien. Narrated by Mark Gagliardi. Prologue. Michael Benson. He rolls it around on his tongue and in his mind, tasting the familiarity of it. Yet it still feels foreign at the same time. Sitting in the darkened room that was once the refuge for his pack while the painful ball of fire was in the sky burning outside, certain memories begin to integrate with his other thoughts. He feels certain abilities and knowledge come into being, more a knowing of what things are without actually understanding how to use them. New picture images roll around in his head like a fast-moving slideshow, none settling for any length of time before moving on to the next. Michael, as he thinks of himself now, more of a complex picture image rather than actual words, feels other packs nestled in their lairs both near and far, resting the day away before heading out for their nightly hunt. It's more of an awareness rather than actual thoughts or images, much like how a compass points to a magnetic source. He knows he can send out a call to gather them into a pack, but waits, wanting to get used to his new awareness. As the slideshow of new thoughts flickers through his mind, it integrates with previous memories. The flashes of light he noticed on previous night hunts triggers a feeling that these are not good for him or the packs, and should be avoided at all costs. He doesn't know what they are, but fears they don't bode well. Michael also remembers the loud bangs heard at times throughout the night, and the strewn, mutilated bodies of his kind lying on the paved streets when he investigated the noises. Without knowing how, he knows the bangs were directly associated with the loss of pack members, including his own. He searches ways to avoid these, but without knowing how they work, the answer lies hidden, yet just on the edge of awareness. Sitting with his back to the cold wall, with his knees drawn to his chest, he feels a frustration, much like when prey escapes, or when he's unable to gain entrance to a two-legged lair. He feels that somehow all of this is associated with the two-legged ones, holed up behind the tall walls of their lair just down the road. Yes, he knows the word road, rather than hard path, now. Just as he knows the flashes of light and associated bangs that accompany his run-ins with the two-legged ones, resulting in the loss of many of his and neighboring pack members, are guns. The danger of the two-legged for him and others of his kind increases his fear. Fear mixes with anger, aimed at them for the losses. He slowly rocks back and forth. His self-awareness continues to grow, and he feels pleased. Somehow, knowing that his newfound knowledge will give him an extra edge in gathering food and combating the two-legged ones, he plans to call to the others when the time is right. For the moment, though, he will keep to himself. The gathering will take place only when he is ready. But for now, he will scout and become more comfortable with his new self. One uncomfortable thought arises with his new cognizance. He knows he and the others are limited in their ability to travel distances in search of food, the distance dictated by the hours of the night and the ability to find shelter from the painful, deadly, burning light of the day. He also becomes acutely aware of his ability to communicate in more detailed and complex images than others of his kind. They won't be able to understand, so he will have to learn how to convey these advanced thoughts into images that others will comprehend. Michael knows this will require him to micromanage the actions of his pack more while on the hunt, but he understands better how to trap prey. New thoughts surface about how to gain entrance to previously inaccessible lairs. These ideas are overwhelming to his senses, and for that reason alone, he will hold off the call to the packs. He stretches out his legs and slides along the wall to the floor to rest, until the call of the hunt brings him out of his slumber. his eyes open to the darkness of the small room. He senses other packs also coming out of their rest and readying for the nightly hunt. Rising, he becomes sharply aware of his missing pack members. The hunt will be more difficult without them, but he needs to let the overwhelming aspect of his awareness settle before gathering others. He steps away from the room, alone for the first time in a long while, and enters the vast main area of the store. Safeway, he thinks, remembering the sign on the building when he first came to following the loud explosion of light and noise. Trotting to the broken glass entry, he carefully steps into the night, painfully aware of what happened the last time. Members of his pack lie scattered around the entrance, their bodies torn asunder and in pieces. Michael casts his eyes about, looking for anything outside of what he knows as normal. Seeing nothing, he steps further onto the paved surface of the parking lot. He lifts his nose into the air and, gathering what scent the still air of the night holds, glances toward the large lair of the two-legged one situated a short distance to his left. Standing amidst the mutilated bodies of his former pack members, anger boils to the surface. Another time, he thinks, catching a faint odor of prey riding on the night air. Turning to his right, he heads down the darkened streets to track down the smell of food. Running through the streets, he senses other packs searching the streets and adjacent fields for food. He knows that his new abilities will place him ahead of other pack leaders, and he will be like a magnet to them. They will recognize him as an advanced pack leader and be drawn to him. He doesn't want that to happen as yet, not until he tests his new awareness. Practice makes perfect. The phrase arises out of nowhere, yet he knows this is just another past memory surfacing. He shuts out the ability of the others to sense him. He's surprised by his ability to do this, and is taken aback momentarily as his sense of the other packs vanishes. His head clears of any thought of and from them. He stops, startled, and then continues his hunt down the darkened streets, his pounding feet echoing off the buildings to either side. When I'm ready, he thinks, cornering a small night animal in the backyard of a burned neighborhood. The kill is quick, and he settles down to feast. Storytime. A Tale is Told.
Jack, what the hell is going on?
Lynn finally intrudes on my wish for quiet. They've cornered a small pack of dogs, I answer.
What the hell does that mean?
Lynn asks, looking at me with a strange expression on her face. Her question shakes me out of a reverie-like state. Images continue to flash through my head without actually interfering with other thoughts. Well, as much as is possible. Right now, a squirrel passing by will interfere with my thoughts. The pictures that float through are in a separate part of my mind. Cohesive, but separate. They're similar to a picture story, but as a form of communication. The images themselves actually depict whole thoughts, ideas, and actions.
Jack,
Lynn asks, trying to get my attention. I shake my head and look down at her. What? I say, leaving my reverie once again.
What the hell does that mean? Who has cornered a pack of dogs? And what dogs? What the fuck are you talking about?
She asks. I honestly don't know. I have these images in my head, and it's like they're talking to me. I know and understand what's happening through them, I answer, as another series of images flashes through. These new images are not serene, as they flash uninvited into my mind. As I try to figure out what is going on, I realize the images aren't exactly like pictures or anything coming directly from sight. It's not like looking through someone else's eyes. The forming images definitely represent ideas, actions or thoughts.
What the hell, Jack? What is it exactly that you understand?
Night runners, I answer, still stunned by the revelation.
You can see and understand night runners, Jack? Are you sure you're feeling okay?
Lynn asks, wondering if I finally flipped or am on some trip. She's definitely concerned. I feel fine, and I'm not sure what is going on. This is just as crazy to me as well.
So you're saying you can read the minds of night runners? Can you read my mind, Jack?
You're thinking I'm crazy and wondering what mushrooms were included with dinner.
Oh, okay, so you can read minds. Oh, my bad. Seriously, though, Jack, what is going on?
I really wish I knew. All I know is I'm getting these images in my mind, and I can't understand them. I don't want them, and they're coming without my asking for them, I answer, feeling stunned and wondering if I'm not, in fact, going crazy. I can normally figure things out pretty quickly, but this one eludes me. Well, that's not entirely true. I have a big idea about what's going on, but I'm not ready to face or voice it yet. Something strange is happening, and happened. That's for sure. Exactly what and what it means is anyone's guess. A flicker of fear surfaces. I mean real fear. Not the anxiety of the unknown or the rush of adrenaline a firefight brings, but fear, such as I've not felt in a long, long time. I'm hungry. Let's go finish dinner, I say, turning back toward the stairs. Oh, and Lynn, I think we should keep this to ourselves for the time being. At least until I can figure out what the hell is going on.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't even know how to bring something like this up. Most would think you've gone off the deep end, and others would be fearful, Lynn responds.
Do you think I'm crazy? I ask as we start up the wooden steps.
No, Jack. I don't know what's going on inside that head of yours, like I ever did, but I don't think that you're crazy. Well, any more than you already are.
I'd like to take Craig out and train him on the 130 in between our search for survivors, so we have a few pilots who can fly it just in case, I say as we continue our climb up the wide steps.
I thought you were heading out to look for soldiers' families.
Yeah, I was going to head out right away, but I want to make sure things are good here first. I think there's some lessons to be learned from our last little encounter with the Marauders. The Night Runners were held at bay to some degree by lighting the perimeter and clearing out the immediate area. I'd like to do the same here before I leave, I answer.
I'm sure Craig wouldn't mind learning, but you'll have to ask him. What were you thinking in regards to clearing the area?
Now let's talk about it in tonight's meeting. Heads turn in our direction as we approach and settle at the table. Questions arise in the eyes that are focused on me with regards to my rising to go stare out of the door, but there are no actual inquiries. I pick up the fork, still with its last uneaten bite attached, and begin where I left off before leaving the table. I continue dinner like nothing happened, but with the images still flying through my mind. They do seem to have settled into a more orderly fashion and aren't quite as pervasive as they were when they first came. They are, however, still weirding me out. I'm still not sure they're even real. I mean, it's not like I can verify what I'm hearing. I can't just walk up to a night runner and ask. I'm not sure they'd respond kindly to a friendly tap on the shoulder. A particular image flashes in my mind. I try sending a thought out. An image of thought, if you will. It's a mental scream of, shut the fuck up. The image I get in return is a sense of being startled, and that particular sequence of images goes silent. Interesting, I think, forking another bite into my mouth. The group meeting that evening covers a variety of subjects. Bannerman begins by mentioning that we're ready to begin bringing in livestock and horses if they can be found. The barns and stables are about finished. With the weather holding for the most part, they should be okay outside until the buildings are complete. I mean, I'm no rancher by any stretch, but I've talked with others who are more familiar with that, and they said it should be okay, he says. We just need some cattle transport and horse trailers in addition to actually finding any livestock which are still alive. I'd like to send a team or two out to locate some. I can do flyovers in the area to see if I can spot any, I respond. I have an idea where some were located before all of this went down. Sounds good, Bannerman replies. I think this should be included among the many priorities we have going on right now.
I agree, Driscoll says. Is the plan still to head out right away to look for the families of the soldiers?
I was thinking of doing just that, but I think we may have to delay that now. I think the folks at the high school had the right idea of keeping the night runners at bay. We do have the walls, but that doesn't mean they're insurmountable. If we've learned one thing, it's that night runners are extremely adaptable. I'm thinking we should clear the immediate area out soon.
Any thoughts on how to go about that? Frank asks.
Well, I guess there are a variety of ways we could do it, I answer. We could demolish the buildings in the area and deny them a place to stay. If we need to use any of the larger, single-story buildings for some reason, we could drop the roof and install some sort of structure that allows the light in, so they can't stay in them.
How are you planning to take down the buildings? Artillery? Tanks? C4?
Driscoll asks. Is anyone here familiar with using artillery or tanks? I ask in reply.
Not that I'm aware of,
Lynn answers. I know I'm not, and I'm pretty sure if I tried either, the results wouldn't be pretty, I say. I'm sure if I tried operating a tank, or any form of artillery for that matter, there would be people running for their lives.
So C4 it is, Driscoll says.
Yeah, that or I was thinking of using an AC-130, I say.
Oh, you have one of those in your back pocket, do you?
Greg asks. No, but I know where some are located. Plus, it'll be very helpful for cleaning up the area at night, I answer. On the plus side, we'll also be able to look for any families in the New Mexico area. I'd like to train Greg on the 130, and we'll be able to fly both 130s back.
So what do we want to do with the buildings? Skylights or demolish them? Greg asks.
We've taken most of the supplies we can use out of them. If we were to take the idea of skylights to the maintenance and storage buildings at Fort Lewis, store our vehicles there, and put in some security measures against marauders, that should be sufficient for our needs, Bannerman offers. So it's demolish them then? I say, questioning the group.
It makes sense. Plus, if we also clear out the trees and everything around us, we'll have a pretty long line of sight, which can only be a benefit.
Lynn is the first to answer.
What about the distribution centers? Are we still planning to hit those after the family recoveries?
Greg asks. How are we on supplies? I ask Bannerman, deferring Greg's question. Hey, we're doing pretty well for the time being. The influx of people will drain us more quickly, but we're good for now, Bannerman answers. So I'm thinking we reserve going to the distribution centers until we return, unless anyone has different thoughts, I say. No one replies. So, we continue searching for any survivors nearby, building the greenhouses, walls, and animal enclosures, and with the training for everyone. I'll start taking Craig up in the afternoons if he's agreeable, and we'll search for any livestock still in the area. After Craig has a handle on the 130, we'll head down to New Mexico and pick up an AC-130, do a quick search for families around the Clovis and Lubbock areas, and then start on the DCs. After that, we start clearing the area out around here, and then it's off to find other families, I say, almost out of breath.
Sounds like a plan, Driscoll says, with everyone agreeing.
We're still under a time crunch with regards to heading out to search for soldiers' families, but I think we can wait until we clear the area first. That's after we return from New Mexico, I say.
I'll inform the teams at the morning formation,
Lynn says. She looks at me with a questioning look, determining if I'm going to say anything about earlier this evening. I give a slight shake of my head, wanting to keep this between us for the time being, at least until I have an idea about what is happening and what it might mean. All I know is that I can understand, to an extent, what the Night Runner images are saying, and can pinpoint where they're coming from like a magnetized needle pointing north. I'm still not sure it's real, but it feels that way. I suppose those who go crazy or hear voices might feel the same way, though.
Having lived with being a little crazy for most of my life, I feel like I'd know if the scales tip dramatically. However, there are images in my mind that are some sort of communication, so maybe it has. If they, however, tell me to start mutilating animals, I'll call it good and leave on my own. The next morning dawns bright with the chill in the air. It promises a warm day by noon, but there's a distinct difference in the temperature. There's also a noticeable change in the daylight hours. We are definitely on our way to the short fall season, and winter lies not far behind. Lynn gives a quick brief to the soldiers with regards to the delayed departure to find their families, but promises it's only a short one. There are a few sighs of exasperation, but they take it in stride for the most part. I think they're mostly happy, as we're still going to make the effort. I can, however, sense a restlessness among those selected to go, as if each day decreases the odds of locating their families. Which, of course, it does. But we need to absolutely ensure we are safe and viable through the winter. Our morning run and training passes quickly. The people in training phase one enter the bright day to begin their training. A myriad of activity begins in the parking lot as groups head off to their tasks for the day. The throaty sound of semis starting pervades the atmosphere. Soldiers climb into Humvees to provide escort for the trucks or to safeguard the continued building of walls around the McCord housing and Fort Lewis vehicle maintenance areas. The plan is to build the walls first, clear the areas, and install skylights in the building so we can deny to night runners the ability to reside within. I shower to clean the sweat and grime from the morning's training and have a quick bite before speaking with Craig about training in the 130. He's quite amenable to the idea. He already has numerous hours flying, so the transition shouldn't take too long. The window of being able to fly is quickly closing, which will definitely limit our range and abilities to reach out over a greater distance. This doesn't concern me greatly, but it'll still be a limiting factor. The idea that we'll have three pilots who can fly the 130 also brings my goal of using an AC-130 closer to a reality. I asked if he wouldn't mind accompanying me on the morning helicopter run to search for survivors. That way, we'll drop off at McCord afterwards and begin flight training. Craig and I strap into the Kiowa, run through the checks, and begin spooling the rotors up. The trucks have already left the compound on their tasks, so the sound of the helicopter starting overrides the other noises in the area, the shouts accompanying group training, and the pounding in the distance as people continue working on the stables and the buildings. The rotors work up into a blur, launching dust and small pieces of debris outwards. The skids go light, and we take off into the blue-skied morning. Frank has us working the area to the northeast of the bases with a planned meeting point where Highway 512 joins with I-5. The task of eventually covering the entire area is a vast one, but we'll take it one area at a time and do the best we can. We'll hit the places Frank opts for daily until Craig becomes proficient and we can head to the southwest. Upon returning, we'll continue searching other areas on days we can until we have either covered the entire western area of Washington or we run out of flying time. The smooth air of the morning is a blessing as we pass north, overfly the bases, and begin broadcasting. The thought arises that we'll have to see about different living quarters soon, as we continue to bring in survivors. We fly over the region, sending our message to ears that can hopefully hear it and respond. Craig takes a few turns on the Kiowa, which he handles well. Handles well, that is, if he was attempting to mimic a roller coaster ride. It's not that I'm that much better, though. We finish with our coverage, radio to let Frank know we're finished, and park next to the pair of 130s sitting on the transient ramp. We step in through the crew entrance of the C-130. I begin covering the systems to acquaint Craig with the triple redundancy of the aircraft, and we strap into the seats. I'll cover the flight engineer tasks, which will slow us with most activities. We taxi out and begin our run down the runway. Lifting off into the clear day, we bank around to the south, watching the glory that is Mount Rainier swing through our windshield.
The sun gleams off its snow-topped peak. Continuing south, we claw for altitude. I chose south so that we can combine training with a search for livestock. Craig takes control of the aircraft as we drone through the sky, the glistening waters of Puget Sound off to our right. We practice the basics, which Craig quickly gets the hang of, and start running through emergencies. Taking a break from training, we look around Olympia for any livestock. I know of some areas that had cattle before our situation changed so drastically. Descending to get a better look, I take us around fields in the outlying areas. Dark spots dot the first pastures we find. Circling, it becomes apparent that the dark spots are unmoving cows lying in the grassy fields. Descending further, the mutilations become clear. Most of the meat has been removed, leaving the cattle just a pile of bones wrapped in hides. It is quite apparent that the night runners have visited here. Well, I guess any fields close to cities aren't going to yield us much, I say over the intercom as we expand our search. It kind of looks that way, Craig responds with his eyes still glued to the devastated cows below us. I want to ask Craig what took him so long getting here, but leave that to a time of his own choosing. I'm sure Lynn has already asked that question and about her other family members, but she hasn't shared the story as of yet. That leads me to believe it doesn't have a happy ending attached to it. We continue our search in ever-expanding arcs away from the city, only to find similar circumstances. The thought of the long time between everything happening and now also leads me to believe we won't find many chickens still alive either. Even if the night runners haven't found them, they'll have starved in their coops unless they were allowed to roam. Let's try further south along I-5, I suggest, after flying over the fifth field full of dead, mutilated cattle. I know there were a lot of ranches along that road, and it may be far enough away from populations that night runners might be scarce. Sounds good, Craig replies. We fly over the low-lying, forested hills south of Olympia, and pick up I-5 on the other side. Turning south, we sweep out of the hills and over flatter, grassy plains. The ranches, I remember, were alongside the highway, so we paralleled it. It isn't long before I pick up the shape of cattle in grass fields surrounded by acres of fencing. There are indeed some motionless shapes in the tall grass, but we also find an equal number of standing cattle in some pastures. The fields where there is still standing water have the greatest number of those still alive, while those where the water was pumped into troughs and are subsequently dry are filled with the motionless, dark shapes. I radio back to base to update Frank and Bannerman on our find and give the locations.
Copy that, Jack. I'll talk to Bannerman about finding some cattle trailers and directing some trucks down that way, Frank answers.
I glance at the various fields with their associated buildings. Now, Frank, I see some cattle trailers on some of these ranches. We could just drive the tractors down and hook up to the ones here, I radio.
Sounds good. I'll talk to Bannerman and get back to you.
Okay, we're going to continue here for a while and then head back your way, I reply.
We'll be looking for you, Frank says.
Craig and I fly on, getting acquainted with the controls and systems before heading back for touch-and-goes. He's used to smaller jet aircraft, so it takes a while to get the hang of flaring higher, but he eventually becomes proficient at getting us down without requiring a chiropractor or possible back surgery. I'm sure the aircraft is thankful as well. We finish up the day, hop over to refuel the helicopter, and head back to base. It definitely won't take too long for Craig to become proficient, and we'll be able to head to the southwest. I would like to have another pilot trained, as we'll have only 3 pilots and 1 flight engineer to spread between 2 aircraft, normally needing 4 pilots and 2 engineers. My thought is to have Robert, Craig, and Bree in this 130, and I'll fly the AC version back myself. We'll fly in formation in case of trouble, but flying a 130 alone is not something I really want to tackle. It'll be a constant flurry of arms and elbows. It can be done if nothing goes wrong, but the after-takeoff checks and pre-landing checks will get a little sporty. Maybe I'll bring Gonzalez along on subsequent training flights and have her train with Bree. I would try and train Gonzalez myself, but training two people at once might result in turning the 130 into a fast-falling brick. That's definitely not a flight characteristic I'm interested in experiencing. With the sun lowering into the western sky, we skirt low over I-5 heading south to Cabela's. Below us is a small convoy of trucks and Humvees heading in the same direction, their tasks complete for the day. It's another day with our walls around the housing areas and vehicle sheds creeping a little further along. From the number of trucks below us, I'm guessing Frank and Bannerman decided to gather the livestock tomorrow. There is a comfort seeing the trail of vehicles, knowing we're still alive to see another day, and that our plans are approaching some sort of fruition. We survived the initial surprise and onslaught to find a relative peace and security in the evenings. We're not there by a long shot, but we are a day closer. That is, if there is such a thing as a point of arrival, and if the night runners behave. The nightly meeting is a recap of the day's events. Bannerman relates progress on the buildings, which are nearly completed, and plans to redirect the trucks and crews southbound to pick up the livestock Craig and I found. That shouldn't set us back long on the walls around the housing and vehicle areas. The walls should be finished within the next few days if we have decent weather, Bannerman relates. After we finish with the stables, barns, and greenhouses, I'd like to use the crews to attempt moving one of the water towers in the area to our location. Now, will that take away from any of our other endeavors? I ask. Bannerman pauses before replying. No, I think we should be able to keep on with the walls and gathering of supplies. I won't really know until we take a look at what relocating one will entail, he answers. Once it's in place, though, we won't have to rely on the pump near as much, except to fill the tower, that is, and we'll be able to provide a decent watering system for any livestock we bring in. Okay, I think we'll be ready to head south to look for some of the families and pick up the AC-130 within the next couple of days. Once we clear the area out, I think that'll give us more breathing room to focus on our move to the bases. Oh, and I'm thinking of taking Red, Blue, and Echo teams down, if that won't interfere with anything here. I address both Lynn and Bannerman.
No, we should be good,
Lynn answers. Yeah, I don't see a problem with manpower, although that will slow building the wall some, Bannerman replies. And we shouldn't be gone for more than 5 days, I say. The overall plan is to fly down to Cannon AFB, spend the next day looking for Gonzalez's family, head over to Lubbock and look for McCafferty's the day after, refuel at Cannon AFB and pick up the other aircraft, then beat Cheeks home. Lynn updates everyone on the training programs currently underway.
The current class in Phase 1 should be finishing on time in a couple of weeks, along with the second class going through Phase 2.
That'd be nice to have others trained. Are there any that look like they'll be good permanent additions to the teams? I ask.
Now, there are a couple that show promise, but I won't really know until they finish. So far, no one has asked to be on a team, but we've really only started. We'll just have to wait and see,
Lynn answers. How many did we pick up today? I ask, directing my question toward Dreskel.
No one showed up, Dreskel replies.
This comes both as a surprise and not one. It's surprising because we've always had people show up at the previous meets. It's not a surprise because we were close to the bases, and with the activity we've shown around there, anyone close would have already responded. At least one would think. Well, we'll just keep at it. I guess we're not going to find people everywhere we try, I say. The meeting breaks up without much fanfare to add, and we retire to our various cubicles. The living cubicles Bannerman has arranged cover almost the entire second floor. There are over 100 people occupying our little sanctuary, and we'll have to come up with additional space soon, especially if we find a greater number of survivors. Lynn and I adjourn to our little living space, which isn't much more than a couple of cots set within wooden walls and a blanket covering the entrance. We plop down on our beds, almost in unison. I'm hesitant to ask my next question, but curiosity gets the better of me. "Hun, have you spoken with Craig about what took them so long to get here?" I ask with hesitancy. Lynn looks at me, and then down at her lap, but not before I see the beginnings of tears in her eyes. She remains silent as she contemplates her lap. "I'm sorry. We won't talk about it if you don't want to. But when you do, I'm here," I say, feeling tightness grip my heart. I feel bad for her and for my insensitivity in asking. I should have waited for her to bring it up.
"No, that's okay," she finally says with a sigh. "Jack, what I haven't told you before is that my sister is, or was, a drug addict. You know my sister and I don't talk much, and we haven't in some time. I never told you this because I was ashamed of her and didn't want any connection with her lifestyle."
Lynn pauses briefly before continuing.
"Anyway, Craig and Mom landed, found a car, and drove to my dad's house. My dad wasn't around, but they found my sister in the house. She was going through pretty bad withdrawals, so they stayed with her. By that time, they had a pretty good idea of what was going on, so they fortified the house as best they could, and Craig foraged for water and food. It took my sister a little while to recover, and, according to what Craig said, it wasn't pretty. They had to keep quiet during the night, as I guess you can expect, but that was hard to do, especially with what my sister was going through. They managed, with one of them staying with her every hour during the night to keep her quiet. Well, she eventually started coming around and feeling better to the point that Craig and Mom talked about leaving to meet up with us here. That's when my sister disappeared. They were both exhausted and fell asleep close to dawn one day, and when they woke, she was gone. Craig searched the area during the day and then stayed, hoping she would return. He said the hardest were the nights when they heard the screeches of the night runners and envisioned her out there defenseless. They stayed for a week and a half afterwards before Craig decided they couldn't stay there indefinitely and should be moving on. But Mom wouldn't have any part of it. She told Craig he should go on, but that she would stay and wait for my sister. Well, of course, Craig wasn't going to leave Mom, so they stayed. My sister never returned, and finally Mom agreed she wasn't going to. That's when they made their way here.
Still staring at her lap, Lynn finishes with a silence that is deafening. Several tears fall onto her fatigues. Reaching over, I pull her close. She buries her head against my shoulder, and her body shakes as she weeps for the loss of her sister and dad. There isn't anything I can do except offer her my shoulder and hug her for as long as she needs. Her body eventually stops shaking, and she pulls away to look into my eyes.
"Thank you. I needed to get that off my chest," she says, and lies down.
I wrap my arms around her, and we fall asleep. Her story is a reminder that the world is not a safe place. I feel grateful for our place and the people around us that make it relatively safe. I still have the images in my head, but they've been relegated to a place that I can control. I drift off to see what my dreams hold.
The sound of feet slapping on the pavement is a familiar one, one that he has heard every night while on the hunt. The small pack he joined a while ago is running ahead down the darkened streets. A faint scent of prey lingers, but the swirling of the air around the buildings makes it hard to determine the actual direction. He is hungry, and the odor indicates a meal that will feed the entire pack if they can get to it first. Buildings pass as they turn down street after street, searching,
The screams of other packs drift on the night air in the distance. Images of prey found filter into his head. They're too far away to respond. His pack leader has found food on most of their nightly hunts, and he is sure they will feed tonight. The scent grows strong down one street, and the pack turns. Adrenaline surges as the thrill of the hunt takes over. Several streets later, with the smell of food growing stronger, he stops. Grabbing his head from the overwhelming pain, he sinks to his knees. A dizzy feeling accompanies the deep ache, making him feel that he's going to fall completely to the ground. He vaguely hears the sound of his pack members' feet stop. The sense of them, once strong and providing a sense of assurance, fades and then vanishes altogether. "Where the hell am I?" he thinks, looking down at the pavement below his head and slumped over body. "How the hell did I get here? Where is here?" The last memory he has is of taking the flu shot and feeling like shit. He headed to bed and is now kneeling on some unknown street. The only thing that comes to his fuzzy and confused mind is that he must have sleepwalked in a feverish dream. A loud shriek penetrates his thoughts, and he looks up. The night is dark, but he makes out ghostly figures running toward him a short distance away. "What the fuck?" he thinks, watching them close in quickly. More screams issue from four figures racing his way. He knows a good thing when he sees it, and this definitely doesn't fit in that category. Adrenaline pours into his body, and he starts to rise with the flee portion of the flight-or-flee response taking hold. He's only able to bring his arm up in an attempt to ward off the bodies as the nearest ones leap into the air and slam into him. The impact knocks him backwards and slams him to the ground. He's only vaguely aware of the growling and snarling above him as his head contacts the hard, paved surface, bringing stars to his eyes. His mind is reeling from the confusion, but is quickly supplanted with sheer pain. He feels more than sees teeth biting into his face, neck, and arms. He recognizes a scream, which rises above the others, as his own. Pale, snarling faces reeking of body odor are close to his. He fights and squirms to get away from those on top of him, and the agony. Chunks of flesh are torn from his cheeks and throat. A part of his mind wonders where this odd, vivid dream came from. He has never felt pain in his dreams before. Another part of his mind knows this is not a dream, but the confusion of suddenly being in a foreign place doesn't allow that thought to filter into his consciousness. There's only the struggle and intense agony. He feels another strip of flesh ripped from his face. He screams, and pain, colored red, floods his mind. His vision fades, and then goes dark. He was right about one thing. The pack would feed well tonight.
The next few days are a repeat. Frank notes areas for Craig and me to fly over, broadcasting for survivors. Gonzalez, McCafferty, Bree, and Robert are on board for the daily 1:30 flights. Bree instructs both Gonzalez and McCafferty on the systems and flight engineer responsibilities. Robert takes some stick time as well to refresh his skills. Bannerman sends the truck convoy south to pick up the trailers and livestock we found. The learning curve is pretty steep for getting the cattle rounded up and into the trucks. It's not like they could just call "Here, boy," and have them come running. The crews find some horses that were left out in pastures, and those prove useful in rounding up the cattle, at least according to the stories told around dinner. The horses find a home in the stables as well. There weren't many found, as those in the stalls had already succumbed to starvation, lack of water, or, in some instances, night runners. By the end of the week, our pastures have livestock in them. Bannerman also sent trucks to loot the barns of their hay and feed. The barns, stables, and greenhouses have been completed,
and the crews head north again, to begin again on the walls. Bannerman also sends a detail out to look at a water tower, and begins planning for its relocation, if that is at all possible. Craig, Gonzalez, and McCafferty are now fairly proficient with the 130 operations. It's time to head to the southwest, and we excuse ourselves from the nightly training sessions to plan our flight. A meeting remembered. Well, isn't that interesting? I say, plotting our route. Robert, Craig, Bree, Gonzalez, McCafferty, and I are gathered in a semicircle.
What's that?
Robert asks, looking up from the map. Nothing much, really, just that Tacoma, Boise, Salt Lake City, and our far-end destination of Lubbock are in a nearly straight line, similar to those mathematical lines of the pyramids and Stonehenge, only not meaning the same, I say. However, they will make it easy to verify our internal navigation system.
Are we going to use the GPS?
Robert asks. We'll set up the route with both, but I'm not sure the satellites are still in the right position with no one to keep them there. We'll do some verifications en route, though, I answer.
Can we set up the same approaches?
He continues. Well, it depends on what we see on the way. The internal nav system on board is highly accurate, but it certainly isn't near what a GPS is, especially if there's a lot of turbulence. But we'll see. There's a pretty good chance of encountering severe weather once we hit New Mexico. If I remember correctly, the dry line sits right on the New Mexico-Texas border, and the time is right for thunderstorms. The squall lines along there can grow quickly, and are usually prevalent during the afternoons and evenings. We'll have to plan alternate fields along the way, as I'm not at all keen on flying through them on internal nav alone, especially if we have to shoot an approach. Plus, I really hate flying through thunderstorms, I reply.
I remember the ones we flew through on the way to Kuwait were pretty scary,
Bree chimes in. Yeah, and those were gerbil ones compared to what the south and southwest can spawn. And I used the word spawn correctly. It's like comparing a paper cut to being molested with a chainsaw, I say. We finish planning our almost 1,600-mile trip, plotting alternate airfields along the way. Horace and Greg join us after the evening training session, and I go over the route with them. This is so they'll have some situational awareness in case we have one of those unplanned contacts with the ground. Read crash. That way, they'll have some idea about where we are, or at least a clue of where we're supposed to be. I'll keep them updated on our progress. It'll take us about 4 hours to get to Cannon AFB, depending on the winds. I have no way of calculating the winds aloft for our trip, but we'll have plenty of gas. We can fly there and back with what we'll have on board. I wake just before first light. I'm not at all keen on leaving my warm sleeping bag. I feel like rolling over and giving the flight a later start, but the image of towering cumulus clouds enters my foggy mind. The thought of wading our way through the dark masses spurs me off my cot. Well, spur isn't exactly the correct word, but I rise nonetheless, holding my tired head in my hands for a moment before slipping my feet into my boots. Lynn stirs beside me and sits in a like manner. You don't have to get up, hun, I say, wearily, tying my laces.
Yeah, right. Who's going to make sure you get your boots on the right foot?
She answers, sounding as tired as I feel. I glance down to make sure I do have my boots on correctly. Yep, good to go.
Besides, I'd feel bad if I didn't see you off.
There's only the faint stirring of images floating in my mind, and I shove them off to a corner. I hear the faint movement of others in cubicles across the upper floor. Leaning over, I kiss Lynn on the top of her head as she slowly does up the laces in her boots. You know I love you, right? I say.
Yeah, Jack. I love you too,
she responds, looking up. I can see how tired she is. Not just the tired of waking early, but the kind that prolonged time without rest and stress can bring. I positively cannot wait until we reach a place where our stress levels are lowered, and wonder if that can really ever begin. With a sigh, I rise and grab my already packed duffel bag. Pushing the curtain aside, I see that several others who are accompanying us have gathered at one of the large tables downstairs. Horace and Blue Team are making their way down the escalator with bags in hand. I wait by our cubicle entrance for Lynn, taking her hand, and we walk in silence down to where the others have gathered. Craig is gathering the last of our planning notes and the maps, putting rubber bands around the approaches into the Cannon AFB and the other fields we've selected as alternates. He puts these neatly into a large leather publication case. The closure of the snaps is loud in the still interior and has a finality to it. It also signals it's our time to go. We look through peepholes drilled into the security shutters and open them when we see that all is clear. The morning is painted in a blue-gray shade, portending the coming of the sun and another day. High clouds are showing a touch of orange on their eastern edges. Stepping out into the parking lot, a morning breeze rustles against our clothing, bringing a chill to the air. The vehicles sit quietly in the parking lot, as if waiting for the coming dawn as well. Their darkened shapes are still. I hate to break the absolute silence that only the time just before the sun breaks over the horizon can bring. With the sun, I know we have to be on our way. High clouds give an indication that our route may not be clear all of the way. The team members make their way slowly across the lot, their steps showing the tiredness we all feel. Reaching the four Humvees we plan on taking, they begin tossing in their gear. It'll be a cramped ride up to the base with us in the gear and only four of the vehicles, but it's a short ride. We'll leave two on the ramp and load two in the 130. Robert and Bree come out and stand with Lynn and me. Bree rubs her eyes, trying to vanquish some of the sleep she brought with her.
"Good morning, Dad,"
she says, having little success in dispelling her sleepiness. "Morning, Bree," I reply. Robert is sleepy as well and just nods in return. "Robert, would you and Bree go get the helmets out of the helicopter?" I ask.
"Sure, Dad,"
he responds, and they make their way to the helicopter parked on the far side of the ramp. Lynn and I stand at the edge of the entrance overhang, watching the blue-gray of the morning turn to a lighter shade. There's such a peaceful atmosphere that I don't want to shatter it with talk. I long for time to just stop and let us enjoy moments like this. This, however, is just not the nature of time. Its nature is the measure of movement, and so it continues. As long as there is movement, there will be such a thing as time.
"Jack, don't do anything foolish. Come back to me,"
Lynn says quietly. She continues to look out at the soldiers loading the last of the gear. "I'll be back." I glance sideways at her. "I enjoy you too much to rush into a departure from this life, although I've never quite figured out why you stay with me."
"Because you're a dork, but you're my dork. Remember the first time we met?"
she asks with a chuckle. "How could I forget that?"
"You could have gotten us killed, you know,"
she says with a sigh. "That's not true. Well, not entirely. Those guys were horrible shots. Besides, if I would have run into the tree line right away, I wouldn't have gotten your number," I reply. Lynn responds with another chuckle and shakes her head. She pauses a moment.
"Of all the ways to meet, it's pretty clear that we were meant to meet, but at the time I thought, who the fuck does that? It wasn't until later that I fully realized that only you would do something like that. I'm glad you asked and actually called, though."
Lynn looks up at me. "Me too," I say, as the memory of that time takes me back to the moment of our meeting. The sudden gunfire as the door gunner test-fired his weapon startled me and garnered my attention. The helicopter flashed over the lush green canopy just a few feet under the wheels, and wind poured in the open door, bringing the muted roar of the rotors overhead. During the occasional jink and turn, I spied the Chase Blackhawk behind and slightly above. I sat close to the door watching all of this and thinking about the mission at hand, to locate and take out a small rebel training facility. I looked at the rest of the team sitting in the shaking interior. Some were looking outside like me, and some at the floor, all lost in their own thoughts. I felt a tap on my shoulder. Turning, I looked at the crew chief with his helmet on and the tinted visor down. The reflection of my face showed clear on the dark, polished surface, the streaks of my applied camo blending with my boonie hat. Having caught my attention, the crew chief held up two fingers. I then alerted the other team members and mimicked the action of the crew chief, letting them know we were 2 minutes out. We checked our gear one last time and chambered rounds. The second Black Hawk hung back as we proceeded forward. The tops of the trees abruptly gave way to a small field filled with tall grass. The grass transformed to clumps of bushes closer to the trees. The abrupt change, though startling, was expected. The helicopter sank below the tree line and settled quickly into the grassy field, with the rotor wash laying the grass on its side. We were out of the door with the skids just above the field surface and made our way quickly into the trees. The bright sun quickly changed to the murky depths of the jungle as we proceeded a few meters in, our transport already out of sight and sound. Finding some dense foliage, we laid up for 20 minutes to ascertain whether our infill was detected. The chirps of birds and sounds of the jungle became normal after a few minutes. We released the helicopters and began our slow progress under the triple canopy toward the suspected training camp location, with the oppressive heat and humidity tracking our every step. After about an hour into our slow, quiet approach, my radio crackled in my earpiece with an incoming call. I always carried my own radio. "Viper, Steel Rain, stand by for an incoming message," a voice from our overwatch said. "Steel Rain, Viper 6, stand by 1," I replied. I caught up with and tapped our slack man, telling him to have our point find a secluded space to hold up in. We made our way into another dense patch of leafy bushes and set ourselves in a circular perimeter. "Steel Rain, Viper 6, go ahead with transmission." "Viper, your mission is to abort. Repeat, your mission is an abort. Acknowledge," the radio operator said. "Steel Rain, copy abort," I replied. Another voice came on the radio. "Viper 6, you're being redirected. Proceed to your infill landing zone for pickup. Assets will be on station in 30 mics. Will you be able to comply?" the new voice said. I thought about it for a moment, looking at the map. We'd be able to make it, but we wouldn't be as quiet on the way out as we were on the way in. "Roger that, Steel Rain. We'll be there," I answered. "Viper 6, you're being redirected to assist an army unit that's come under fire. You're the closest. Further instructions and material will be provided upon pickup. Out. Acknowledge." "An army unit? What the hell's an army unit doing out here?" I thought, as I pressed the mic button. "Copy. Viper 6 out." "Okay, guys, we're turning it around. Apparently, we have to go rescue an army unit that strayed too far from home. We'll have more info en route," I told the team and directed the point to take us back to the infill landing zone for pickup in 30 minutes. We made it to the field with only minutes to spare. "Viper, Eagle inbound for pickup. 5 minutes out," the radio crackled as we laid up in the surrounding trees. "Eagle, copy. We're on the north side and all is quiet," I responded. A minute passed. "Viper, Eagle, pop smoke." I readied and tossed a smoke canister into the grassy field. A hiss and then purple smoke began streaming up into the still air. "I've got grape smoke," our pickup pilot said. "Copy grape, Eagle," I verified. The faint sound of a helicopter entered the area, and it soon flashed over the treetops to settle onto the field. We dashed out of the tree line and boarded quickly. The Black Hawk lifted off immediately. I settled in next to the crew chief. "What's the skinny?" I asked, shouting at the helmeted chief.
"Sir, an army squad was ambushed and forced into a clearing. You'll be landing here."
The crew chief pointed at a map which he handed to me. He then showed me where the unit was under fire.
"We'll be landing your team a few clicks to the north in another open field where you'll make your way south."
"Assets?" I asked, meaning what assets would we have available or were on their way.
None, sir, he replied. Other than the assets for your insertion and subsequent pickup, that is, we have more transport units on the way.
I looked at the map and then the chopper we were in.
We can't go in for a direct pickup. The LZ is too hot,
the chief said, seeing where my thoughts were going. And what about using the door gunners for support? I asked as we gained altitude. The roar of the wind through the open door was forcing us to shout.
No can do, sir. ROE, rules of engagement. We can't directly support with helicopter assists,
he answered.
Stupid fucking rules. Engagement is engagement. Apologize later,
I thought, looking over the map again.
Well, nothing I can do about it, so I might as well get the info we need.
What's an army unit doing out here? I asked.
They're apparently a squad training indigenous folks. They were ambushed while conducting a patrol with their trainees.
Casualties?
Unknown, sir,
he answers, passing me another piece of paper.
Contact call signs, freaks, and authentication codes. Exfil assets will be on standby.
Okay, thanks, chief, I said, and proceeded to brief the team on the mission, insertion, and route of march. We'll head south from our infill and make a plan once we get there and ascertain the situation. No firing unless we're spotted or fired upon. I'd rather not make our presence known right away, I said as the helicopter dropped down to nap of the earth flying. Our insertion was to be a field in a small valley several clicks north of the entrapped unit. We were inserted into the field and made our way south through the double canopy jungle with open areas in the next valley. As we neared the last ridge between us and the trapped unit, we began to pick up gunfire on the other side of the small ridge line. It sounded like all hell was breaking loose on the poor unfortunate souls trapped in the open. The gunfire sounded mostly like AK-47s, but we heard the occasional sound of an M-16 drift in.
Okay, slow and steady,
I told our point, and we headed quietly up the ridge. The sound of gunfire increased dramatically when we neared the top. Cresting the ridge, the faint smell of gunpowder mixed with it. The dense undergrowth of the jungle thinned on the other side. We halted, and I saw an outcropping of rock on the side. I signaled toward the rocks, and our point led us there. We crept on our stomachs out onto the small outcropping looking south. I directed the team to angle claymores to our east and west, with an additional one to our rear. Close to the edge of the flat surface of the rocky ledge, its hot surface burning my chest and stomach through my shirt, I was afforded a view of the area. Directly below us to the south was an open, grassy field. Well, once even grassier, but the volume of fire and steel filling the air had mowed quite a bit of that down. The field itself was full of small, hilly areas. Behind the small rises in the field were the prone bodies of soldiers firing into the surrounding tree lines. If not for the presence of the small hills, the unit below would probably have been overrun in short order, as the volume of fire coming from tree lines on three sides was intense. Green tracers sped through the open area thick enough to walk on. Red tracers sped out from the soldiers in the field. It looked like a laser battle. Smoke from the gunfire lingered on the edges of the field and within it. To the east, minimal gunfire was being directed into the field, and that caught my attention. I pointed to the area, and we backed off the ledge.
Let's make our way to the east and see if it's clear. We'll pull the unit through that way if it is, and conduct a fighting withdrawal to the LZ. I'm assuming there are casualties, so we may have to divert or stall those following, I said, once we were clear and our claymores pulled in.
So we'll assist from outside the lines, clearing a hole for them to get through,
the assistant team leader asked. That's the plan, I said. The smiles were thin, but there nonetheless. See, there's nothing like coming up behind a force and surprising the shit out of them, especially seeing we had suppressed weapons. They'd never know we were there, and it was my plan to keep it that way. I dialed in the freak given to us.
Atlas 21, this is Viper, over,
I called, whispering. Blank airspace greeted my attempt at communication.
Atlas 21, this is Viper 6, over,
I called a moment later. Again, no reply. I switched frequencies back.
Eagle, this is Viper. Over.
Viper, Eagle, go ahead, came the response.
I can't make contact with Atlas 21. Confirm the freaks we were given are accurate, I said.
They are confirmed, Viper.
Can you try raising them and act as a relay?
I asked. Roger, stand by.
Eagle came back a few moments later, informing us that they had negative contact with Atlas 21.
Copy that. Viper out,
I said, rethinking our plan.
Without contact, we ran the risk of absorbing friendly fire and unable to relay our plan for getting them out. We had to head inside. The volume of gunfire being poured into the field didn't make the odds look good, but there were soldiers down there needing help, and there's no better reason to try what we could.
Okay, change in plans, I told the team. I can't raise anyone down there. We'll head to the east as planned, and then I'll head inside and make contact.
We made our way east, creeping just below the crest. The firing at the base of the ridge, just 50 meters away, didn't let up. The ridge eventually sloped down, with the ridge ending just at the eastern edge of the field. The trees lining the open area continued to the south along the eastern side. Only a few shots rang out from there. Behind the few firing on that side, we went online and crept forward, keeping in sight of the team member to our left and right. The large leafed vegetation kept our field of vision limited, but the sounds of gunfire guided us in. Luckily, only a few desultory shots were fired in our direction from the soldiers in the field. There was an occasional spray of bark from one of the large trees as rounds made their way in our direction. My concern was how to exit the trees and make my way across the field without becoming the main attraction for the soldiers firing this way. Lowering a large frond, I saw a man laying behind a fallen log firing short bursts blindly into the field.
We have tangos to our front, 15 meters, I whispered into the radio.
The copy and additional sightings were radioed in from the other team members.
Take them out, I said, as I raised my M4 and centered my red dot on the back of the soldier firing in front of me.
My carbine kicked slightly against my shoulder, and the muted coughs of my short burst were hidden beneath the din of the firing all around. The soldier flinched and then settled to the ground. The only difference in the span of moments between his living and his introduction to the next world was that his AK-47 ceased firing. The sounds directly around us diminished as the others found their marks as well. The area to our immediate front became quiet.
Now, how to get to the troops out in the field without becoming aerated?
I thought, edging to the perimeter, keeping low as rounds continued to pepper the trees around us.
Anyone have anything white?
I asked as we drew closer together.
You're kidding, right?
My ATL answered.
I have a hanky,
our point man brandished said handkerchief.
You guys wait here. I'm going in. Keep the comms open,
I said. I tied the white, I might also add used, handkerchief to the end of my suppressor. Lying behind the fallen log next to the recently departed, I waved the small flag overhead and started yelling, friendlies. I heard someone shouting close by and noted the decrease in incoming rounds. Raising my head above the log, I saw a helmet bob up just above one of the rises. I stood and ventured slowly out to the edge of the tree line, keeping my M4 raised into the side along with my other arm. I didn't want to stand there long as the firefight was still in full swing. I yelled, friendlies, once again, and the helmet became attached to an arm waving me on. I crouched and ran into the field, very much aware of the steel filling the air. With some rounds peppering the ground from fire to the left and right, I dove behind the rise which hid the body beneath the helmet.
Where the hell did you come from?
The soldier asked. Oklahoma, I answered as if it was the stupidest question I'd ever heard. Who's in charge here?
Sergeant Connell,
he answered,